white walls, TV antennas in the back. You may not have a car at all, but remember, brothers and sisters,
listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
For African people, nothing important happens without a libation. And so for this very important presentation, we begin by the pouring of libation. We pour libation first to our first ancestor, to that hidden one who, though hidden, manifests in all things as all things, that God-goddess idea in the universe by any and all names. To our first ancestor, we pour libation, Ashe. We pour libation too to our ancestors because they were the first people on this planet, mothers and fathers of all mankind. Flashpoint of the human family. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to our ancestors because they were the ones who first gave birth to the idea of civilization, knew we would need a form of governance, and they nurtured that idea along the Nile until it reached its zenith in Kemet. There they built these gigantic monuments as evidence of that great civilization, and they carved instructions on the walls of temples and tombs for us so we would never forget. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to our ancestors because over time they put together all the tenets of civilization and they took those ideas and left the continent. They were the people of the first Exodus. They left Africa and went all over the world and peopled the world. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. We pour libation too to our ancestors because they did not sit on their laurels. They continued to improve, continued to evolve, and at each point of evolution, they again would leave the continent and settle and resettle the planet. They met themselves coming and going. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. pour libation to those ancestors, because over time, they found themselves the object of a forced exodus when they were kidnapped, shackled, cargoed, shipped out of Africa and enslaved in diasporas around the world. To those ancestors, we pour libation, our shame. Pour libation to the ancestors left at home, the very young, the aged, the infirm, left to reinvent themselves, depleted of us, human resources. But they were enjoined by us in the diasporas, both objects of a global myopia that ruptured the soul of a people as it ravaged a continent. To those ancestors, we pour libation, our shame. Pour libation to those ancestors, because over time, they began to remember who and what they were. Because no matter where they had been dropped off, they still retained bits and pieces of who and what they were. They retained that African core that described them. They began to remember bits and pieces of a song. They began to remember lines from a rhythm. They began to remember dances that they did in ancient times. They began to remember those ancient drum beats that they now beat out on bare skin. And so to those ancestors, we pour libation, our shame. Pour libation too to them, because they then began to teach each other. They began to resurrect and reconstruct that history and that culture. They became the new Africans wherever they were. They became the new teachers, preachers, archaeologists. The new singers, dancers, the new drummers, the new Jalia. They reconstructed that history and our culture and became new Africans everywhere. So to those ancestors, we pour libation. I shame. Pour libation to those ancestors, because they are the ones who passed that information on to us. And so we pour libation to those of you who will watch this presentation. Those of you who are the recipients of that pieced together history, of that reconstructed culture. To you, we pour libation, our shame. Pour libation to our children and those yet to be born. For they are the ones that you must teach. And you can only teach if you know the history. So to you who are learning the history and are passing on that history, and to our children who are learning that history and will pass that history on to all eternity, for they will call your name in all eternity. To our children, we pour libation. Ashe. Ashe. Asheo.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells the people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
Come on and bring on the reparations. Oh, master of the perfect word universe, technological forked tongue, riddle me this. If the Chinese can come from China and the French can come from France, what made you think you could get niggas out of Africa in the first place? Just because you put puppies in the oven, that don't make them biscuits. Reparations on GP. Come on and bring on the reparations. For all the unrequited home runs, brothers be burning up the bases, the crowd be going mad, brothers be crossing over home plate, go outside and can't get a cab. For little Richard teaching the Beatles how to scream like Aunt Jemima without their pancakes. And all the other dark and unknown rockers electrified, the Republic sanctified, shaking that Cold War out the booty body politic. Come on and bring on the reparations. For the beat in beatnik, white Negroes and such, getting off up under that great music in them little ass five spots. For the jazz in the jazz age, making your women wiggle and squirm, and you trying to twist and do the worm. Your abstract expressionism jism dripping, you might say, if I was you, I would go on the road and howl too. Jimmy Dean and Elvis, they can go to wherever they went. Marilyn too, except she got caught in a trick and got bent out of that cute little shape she had going. Come on and bring on the reparations. for the Birmingham Gospels, Four Little Girls Come Sunday, for the Jesus Remix in those redneck streets, Fire Hose, Mad Dog Crucifix, and what exactly did you say you was doing at the time of our soft shoe on the Rock of Ages, for the privilege in your skin, a wounded knee, a trail of tears for the Indian in us. Come on and bring on the reparations. For the spook with the metal detector sitting by your door. Open just enough, probably a moon full of cocaine on the table. Monica on her knees doing secret service. You humming mum under wraps. And what about all those flags we so proudly hailed? Marvin Gaye singing, oh, say, can you see? Wearing shades like mirrors at the All-Star game so you can reflect yourself, relaxed and feeling good. The dark looker doing his looking like he was blind, bearing witness to the whiteness of whiteness, pretending you was the only one who could see. 'Tis after all about thee, just like you like it. Mercy, mercy me, and so on and so forth. For the missing royalty checks, and so on and so forth. For VD and Tuskegee called syphilis, and so on and so forth. Think of it. Think of it as a down payment on the interest compounded. Them 40 acres notwithstanding. That mule notwithstanding. Multiplied, quantized, digitized. What to say about forgiveness between you, huh? And your God. Come on and bring on the reparations.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Hotep and greetings, my sisters and brothers. Thank you so much for joining us today. My name is William Rogers, and I am the host of the Black Reality Think Tank. We are here every Tuesday, and we have a dynamic and engaging conversation that we want to have today. We thank you again, as I said, for joining us. I'd like to remind all of our audience, those who are on the telephone, if you would kindly mute your phone for right now, because all of the noise in the background we can hear. And so if you would do that, I would greatly, greatly appreciate it. Thank you so much. We're going to bring on some of our guests this evening. We have normally our community platform, but we do have a leader who is going to sort of guide us in that process. We're going to be talking about science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. So we prepare for a dynamic discussion. We're going to look at it from different perspectives, and hopefully we'll engage a very powerful conversation. So again, thank you so much for being here with us this evening, and we can look forward to some of our other programs that we'll talk a little bit about at the top of the hour. But as you know, the process, for those of you who are regulars to our program, we do our ancestral profile, and today that profile is a recent member that has just entered that world of our greatness. And his name is Bunny Wailer. Bunny Wailer. He is the last surviving, original member of the Wailers, the Jamaican trio that helped establish and popularize reggae music. And other founders were Bob Marley and Peter Tosh. Brother Wailer died on Tuesday, today, at a hospital in Kingston, Jamaica. He was 73 years of age. His death was confirmed by Maxine Stowe, his manager, who did not provide a cause of his death. The group was formed in 1963 when its members were still just teenagers. The Wailers were among the biggest stars of ska, the upbeat Jamaican style that borrowed from the American R&B. On early hits like Simmer Down and Rude Boy, the three young men who in those days wore suits and had short cropped hair sang in smooth harmony, threading some social commentary and providing do-be-do-be-do-be-wah type music. Let me just ask once more if our audience would please mute your microphones or mute your telephones. Those of you who are on the telephones, could you please do that? All of the noise that you make can be picked up through this very sensitive microphone system. So I'd greatly appreciate if you would do that for us. Thank you so much. The Wailers were Jamaica's Beatles. Randall Grass of Shenachie Records an American label that worked extensively with Bunny Wheeler in the 1980s and 90s, said in a phone interview that this was one of the greatest groups in the history of modern music. By the early 1970s, the Wheelers, now in loose clothes and dreadlocks, became one of the flagship groups of a slower, more muskier new Jamaican sound called reggae. The group's 1973 album, Catch a Fire, with songs like Concrete Jungle and Slave Driver, is one of the canonical releases of so-called roots reggae, with a root-adjacent production style and socially conscious lyrics. Bob Marley and Peter Tosh were the group's primary songwriters and lead vocalists. But Bunny, who had also played percussion instruments, was a critical part of their harmony style. Among fans, at least, the three men settled into the character roles like reggae superheroes. Peter Tosh was the militant one. Then Bob was the poetic revolutionary humanist. And Vivian Goldman, the author of a book called The Book of Exodus, The Making and Meaning of Bob Marley and the Wailers, album of the century, Bunny was regarded as a spiritual mystic. Born Neville Livingston, he took the name Bunny when he joined the group. He was voraciously credited as Bunny Livingston or Livingstone before settling on Bunny Wheeler in the 1970s. The Wailers toured Britain and began to build international acclaim, but by 1973, the original trio had split up. Marley, heading toward global stardom, began performing under the billing of Bob Marley and the Wailers. Bunny disliked touring, and as a follower of the Rastafari faith, he's been uncomfortable performing in bars and viewing them as unsuitable venues for the group's spiritual message. Neville Livingston was born in Kingston on April the 10th, 1947, and he grew up in the village of Nine Mile in St. Anne Parish, which, by the way, is the same parish of the great Marcus Mosiah Garvey, off of the northern coast of Jamaica. He and Marley met as children in that area, and for a time, Marley's mother, who was named Sidella, lived with Neville's father, whose name is Thaddeus, in the Trench Town section of Kingston. The two friends met Peter Tosh, whose real name was Winston McIntosh, through the Joe Higgs of the Jamaican pop duo Higgs and Wilson. And early on, the Wailers also included Junior Brathwaite and Beverly Kelso, and they recorded with top producers of the day, people like Coxum Dodd, Leslie Kong, and Lee Scratch Perry. After leaving the Wailers, Bunny continued to make music, including the first solo album, Black Hard Man, in 1977. He produced it himself, wrote most of the songs, and released it on his own label, Solomonic. But while Marley and Tosh toured widely, Bunny basically largely stayed in Jamaica, where he built a powerful mystique. He made his New York debut in 1986 at Madison Square Garden with opening acts and backup groups like the vocal ensemble, the Psalms, and he had joined and chosen to represent Jamaican musical history. 3 years later, when he performed at Radio City Music Hall, John Pirellis of the New York Times described the show as being like a gospel service with a reggae beat, with Bunny dressed in a robe decorated with the silhouette of Africa, a Star of David, the Lion of Judah, and marijuana leaves. Bob Marley died of cancer in 1981. Peter Tosh was shot to death in 1987. According to Mrs. Stowe, Bunny Wailer's survivors include 13 children, 10 sisters, 3 brothers, and grandchildren. Mrs. Stowe said that John Watt, his partner of more than 50 years, had dementia and had been missing since May. Bunny won the Grammy Award for Best Reggae Album 3 times. 2 of those albums were tributes to Bob Marley. He was given Jamaica's Order of Merit in 2017. Peter Phillips, a minister in Jamaica's parliament, said that his death brings to a close the most vibrant period of Jamaica's musical experience and called him a good, conscious Jamaican brother. All right, my brother. Bunny Wheeler is very clearly a giant in the world of reggae. For those of you who like reggae, I'm sure that you remember this great and wonderful brother. Tonight we're going to talk about STEM, and we are going to look at the question and review the concept of whether or not this system of education is beneficial to African Americans, could be beneficial, and would it awaken that genius that our young people have. As you know, many times we have some very terrible statistics a lot about education for African-American, our African-American children. And so we're looking at STEM and talk a little bit about it. And I've assembled a wonderful panel of people who are very gifted in the topic. Some of them are working in the field of STEM. This topic came about based on an article that I had read talking about evaluating it in terms of what it has done and where it has gone. And also, one of our regular guests, my good friend, Dr. Bruce Bridges, was telling me that he has often done workshops on the history of STEM and talking about its connection. So I thought maybe it would be a real good time for us to kind of look at this whole idea and concept and just see how useful it is and sort of understand it from a think tank perspective. This is the Black Reality Think Tank, and that's what we do. We bring together ideas, talk about them, and hopefully can look at solutions and things that we do. One of the very clear projects that we always push here is we talk about independent schools, and we talk about being able to have our children work in an environment where we are in control of those systems. And so if that's the case, maybe STEM might be something we would want to look at. And so that's what we're going to talk about tonight. Very briefly, let me just give you a little bit of a background of STEM and where it comes from. On January 25th, 2011, the sitting president at this time, whose name was Barack Obama, spoke these words in his State of the Union address. He says, Let's also remember that after parents, the biggest impact on a child's success comes from the man or woman in the front of the classroom. He said, in South Korea, teachers are known as nation builders. Here in America, it's time we treated the people who educate our children in the same way. He said, there is a level of respect that must be given these educators, and good teachers should be awarded and not make excuses for bad ones. And over the next 10 years, with so many baby boomers retiring from our classrooms, we want to prepare 100,000 now teachers in the field of science, technology, engineering, and math. That was his statement. This was a milestone for STEM education, but it was not new as a concept. It was derived by the White House, but it was not a new concept. STEM education, in one form or the other, has been around for a long time, and Dr. Bridges is going to give us that historical background and where that comes from. But nevertheless, looking at the idea and basically its usage in America prior to that, was basically tied into some of the science initiative that was being promoted in the early years, things like the Sputnik project, satellite mission work type of things, and so forth. It used to be called science, mathematics, engineering, and technology, SMET, but at this they decided to move it to a different and call it STEM, which is science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And so all this was, as though this was being promoted, this idea was being pushed by the sitting president of the time. But it goes back much far, back to something even the Morrill Act of 1862 had language such as that. And then even on into World War II, as obviously these industrial nations who are beginning to try to conquer the world need to do so through some form of science. So I'm going to stop there because I want to at least give our panel, who have more knowledge about it than I do, to talk about its background, where it comes from, what it means, is it working? I've asked my very good friend, who's no stranger to the Black Reality Think Tank, James Pugh, who is an engineer. I've asked him to consider talking with us today, and he is here with us. I asked a very good friend from Atlanta, Georgia, Brother Tommy Bourdain, who is running a STEM program now. And he is doing so independently, away from the public school system, and he has some projects that he are doing with young people that is just dynamite. And so we've asked him to join us. I asked Brother Timothy Philadelphia, who is an educator, to join us to discuss his experiences and whether or not he uses STEM in his classroom. And then a very good and new friend, but definitely a dynamic, wonderful one, is Brother Lush out of Montgomery, Alabama, who is a former professor of mathematics at Dillard University. And we ask him to also join us and talk about the STEM idea. So I'm going to go right to Dr. Bridges and ask Dr. Bridges, what is that? What is the historical background of STEM based on that workshop that you do and have been doing for some while? Why don't you give us some facts about that? And first of all, good afternoon to you too, my brother. Dr. Bridges?
All right, I had my mute on. Can you hear me now?
Okay, great. You can come. You can. I hear
trying to follow your orders and your instructions. I had my mute on, didn't turn it off. All right. Hotep to you and to all of our listeners tonight. And I want to thank you very much for doing this program because I think it's a very, very good program. Want to just mention that, first of all, I want to key right in on what was said earlier. As the brother was saying, come on and bring on the reparations.
Oh, yeah.
The more you study African and African-American history, the more you will find we owed a tremendous debt in this country by our European enslavers. Now, when you don't know the history, then you won't understand why people are crying for, shouting out for, exclaiming that we be paid. But when you know the history and you see what African people have done in this Western world especially, they owe us for the building of this whole entire civilization and country. And it becomes very clear when you study science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, because these are the building blocks. These are the building sources of any system or any society. And mathematics being the basis of all of this. And we as African people were involved in the building of this country through the very use of world science, world technology, world engineering, as well as world mathematics. Now, first of all, people may ask the question, why is mathematics so rarely mentioned in the study of the African? And that's really a fact. Most times, people don't mention mathematics in the study of the African. One reason, of course, is the assumption that the African was purely incapable of developing an abstract body of thought. It wasn't believed that we could develop an abstract body of thought. And another reason is the fact that these early anthropologists who were studying in Africa and studying us as a people, they thought that the African was incapable of developing abstract thought, and they had a love affair. I guess you might say these early anthropologists had a love affair with the primitive, and they prefer to tent down among the bushmen of the Kalahari than among African traders, I believe, who are more accustomed in dealing with large, with trading and that kind of thing, as opposed to dealing with Africans who built civilizations and who used mathematics in the monetary system. There's a world of difference between the mathematical thinking of a hunter and a gatherer when you compare that to a trader in an African city-state. Let me make that clear.
Okay.
Not all Africans, first of all, had mathematics. It's true, but neither did all Europeans. Most Europeans got their mathematics from the Greeks, and we're going to talk about that in a few minutes. The origins of Europeans getting it from the Greeks, and then we're going to take it back to where the Greeks got theirs from. So we need to understand that the numerals that we use today, what are called the Arabic numerals, and we call them the Arabic numerals because it was the Arabs who eventually got them accepted by most European traders as the Moorish whole was consolidated. Now, when we look at the Moors, that's going to be another subject that I'm going to talk about as we go on and look at mathematics. Now, when we look at the origin of mathematics and we begin to look at science, we must realize that any student of science, when you go into any science class in a university setting, a high school setting, a seminar, a workshop, anytime you study science, the first law of the scientific method is considered observation. That's the first law of the scientific method. Human beings who were early on the planet Earth, who were Africans in the Nilotic civilizations, in the Kemetic civilizations, and the Ethiopic civilizations, they used the technique of observation to develop science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, because they were early on the stage of civilization. And there were no books that were written. The papyri had not come into being. The writing on stones had not come into being. The cuneiforms had not come into being. So all the human mind had to draw from, to feed upon, to develop itself was what the Creator had put around us in the natural universe. There's another lecture that I did, and I still do, and I did many years ago, called Human Beings First Studied from the Natural Creation, because this is where this knowledge comes from. It comes from. And so we have to understand that the early human beings at the advent of civilization first studied nature, and then out of nature is where they began to understand physics and understand science, understand algebra, understand chemistry, understand gravity, and understand architecture and engineering by studying what was in the environment. And we have to, first of all, trace it down into southern Africa in the area of Ethiopia. And then, of course, it reached its greatest level of development when Africans moved north on the waterway called the Great River Nile, and there those great civilizations were built. As a matter of fact, there's a professor, a white professor, by the name of Professor Lumpkin, and she states in an article that she wrote, it came out, I guess, in about 1980, and she says that the same sort of talents that brought together a centralized government in ancient Egypt that constructed the vast network of irrigation canals, that developed the first phonetic writing and embedded an alphabet into beautiful picture writing, that wrote the first medical treatises, composed a body of literature and phenomenal art that we still admire today, that invented the first ciphers to represent numbers. These were the talents that underlay the ability to create the awe-inspiring pyramids, obelisks, and temples. And everyone knows, even when you look at white mathematicians around the country at some of these white universities, one, for example, by the name of Dr. John Papademos, who's a physics professor at the University of Illinois in Chicago, he made the statement that Greeks generally viewed Egypt as the seat of scientific knowledge. Egypt was viewed as the seat of scientific knowledge, and it was also found that Socrates called the Egyptian god Thoth the inventor of writing, astronomy, and geometry. And Herodotus had a similar high opinion of Egyptian science when he stated that the Greeks learned geometry from the Egyptians. In the world today that we live in, when you go into a mathematics class, when you go into a physics class, when you go into an algebra class, when you go into a chemistry class, as I say in my book, Recapturing the African Mind, when you begin to study these fields of knowledge, when the teacher or the professor asks the student in the class, what is the origin of science? What is the origin, or what is the origin of mathematics? What are the origins of drama and art? Though we're talking about science and mathematics, but they, no matter what it is, the answer to that question has always been Greece. It is always Greece, because Europeans have glorified themselves in history and have cut off the root of their knowledge, the roots of civilization, which came from you and I around the valleys of the Nile River. And even before the Nile River, there were great constructions and monuments and monolithic stones that were built in the great walls of Zimbabwe in southern Africa. So it wasn't just Egypt, but there were other parts of Africa where people were using science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. But by the time Europeans came into power, and I'm jumping up a little bit now, in the 14th century and began to travel out into the world, when they began to go into North America and South America, to the islands of the Caribbean, when they began to travel into India and China and Japan and to the islands of the Pacific, they would always take their versions of everything that has ever been developed, ever been created, or anything that ever was initiated. They would always trace it back to the European and cut off the root. And so this is why it's very important that science, technology, engineering, mathematics, and the African genius be brought forth so that it can be understood, especially by our people, because, as Malcolm said many years ago, it is through the knowledge of history that develops the springs and the motives of human action, and that can cause us to create, to build, to design, to develop, as we're going to talk about tonight. And that's what happened in terms of this African genius that you mentioned before. The Egyptians were the forerunners of the Greeks in applied science also. And when we look at the ancient world, and I'm covering quite a bit now, when we look at the ancient world and we look at the location of Kemet, or the location of Egypt, you'll find that Egypt is in Northeast Africa, along the northern region of North Africa, which is Sahara now. But the Sahara has not always been Sahara. It at one time was the location of a tremendous North African culture, until the harsh sands of desert sands encroached upon the fecund, the fruitful North African continent, and it became desert. So many of the Africans from the civilization of North Africa left North Africa, went onto an island just north of that African continent in the water there, the island of Crete. They developed what was called a maritime culture. Africans left North Africa, got into the water, went over to the island of Crete, and they developed a culture based upon water, which is called a maritime culture. And in them developing a maritime culture, Greek civilization invaded Africans on the island of Crete, who had a capital city called Knossos. They had a capital city with buildings and architect. They designed the whole city, a city without walls. It means that they were not, that they had no problems with people invading them, or no problems with outside agitators or people coming in to destroy what they had built. They had cities with no walls. But the Greeks came upon the civilization of Knossos, or the Cretan civilization, came upon the king, who was called Minos, and destroyed that civilization.
Let me ask you just a quick question. And you know, I don't want to interrupt you, stop you. I just wanted maybe for our listening audience, can you kind of, and I mean, this is a brilliant.
I can't hardly hear you. You're kind of breaking up.
I know somebody in the background is, making some noise. Hold on a second. I'm sorry. Those of you who are on telephone, if you could please just mute your phones temporarily so that we can begin to, you know, hear Dr. Bridges better. Dr. Bridges, can you kind of just give us some idea of some resources based on some of the information that you have that might...
Oh, yeah, no problem. I'm glad you asked that. What I was going to do is kind of hold it to the end, but I can give them as I go. But the only reason I wasn't because of time. And I thought about it when I was preparing this lecture, Dr. Rogers, since we have phone calls and got advertisement. It's just so much, and I was just trying to get as much as I possibly could. But I definitely can. For example, there's a good book where you can read called The Pyramids, An Ancient Showcase of African Science and Technology by Professor Lumpkin. Which is a very good source, and there's another one called The Western Experience, Volume 1, Antiquity to the Middle Ages. So I have my sources. Okay. I was like I said, I was trying to move on. And then there are other sources that you can read. The Stolen Legacy by George G.M. James talks about a great deal about this that we're talking about. And then there's another book called A History of Science, published by the Harvard University Press, that I'm going to be coming out of, a book that came out in 1953. So, and I'm glad you asked that question, because there are so many sources that can back up what I'm saying.
Exactly.
And this is why when white folks come with this stuff and they start talking about algebra, and they start talking about the greatness of Euclid, and talking about, and those who are now listening or understand who Euclid was, when they start talking about Euclidean geometry or the geometry of Euclid, Euclid was born and raised in Africa or in Egypt and never even left Africa. And this is the source of his understanding of geometry. And when you look at the origin of that word geometry, geo, which means the earth, metri, comes from the word meter or measure, you're somehow measuring the earth. So when you look at these Europeans, these white folk have popped up all their heroes and have black folk going around quoting white scholars and white interpreters of history, but because they don't understand and don't know the root. But you have to study to understand. You have to study books like Stanley, the book by Stanley on the life of Pythagoras. Pythagoras, who is given credit, we're talking about mathematics here, Pythagoras is given credit for the theorem A squared plus B squared equals C squared. And when you're solving A squared plus B squared equals C squared, you're solving for the length of the legs of a right triangle. Now let's think about that for a minute. A right triangle, the oldest triangles that we know anything about are the pyramids in the Nile Valley. They're the oldest and most exact built triangles that we know in the history of the world. So they were here before Pythagoras. Where did Pythagoras gather the information A squared plus B squared equals C squared? When you read the history of Pythagoras, you will find that Pythagoras studied in Africa, coming out of Greece, not for 1 year, not for 2 years, not for 4 years to get a bachelor's degree or 6 years to get a master's, but Pythagoras stayed and studied in Egypt on the continent of Africa, where he traveled to from Greece. He stayed there and studied for 22 years. He studied in Africa for 22 years. He studied in the Nile Valley, where the pyramids already stood majestically, and he understood A squared plus B squared equals C squared. Africans already knew how to solve for the length of the legs of a right triangle. The oldest triangles we know anything about are the pyramids.
Right. So,
I'm going to make just one statement. We as people have to stop and investigate these lies and falsehoods that Europeans have placed upon us, and really study and critically analyze. We need to study and critically analyze how these bridges and these universities and these museums and waterways and tributaries were built in this country. But go ahead, Dr. Rogers.
I wanted to just ask you about so basically then, you know, in what you're saying, and like you said, you know, it's a lot of stuff. And,
it's a whole lot, brother.
It's a whole lot, I know, and I know you can only have limited time to do it. But when we talk about STEM and whether or not black children can embrace that, it was already embraced. It's kind of what you're saying in providing this background history from us, that it is a part of the culture. So it's already embedded into the DNA of African people. Now, am I correct
you know
to say
what?
That?
You're absolutely correct, and I'm glad. I'm glad you're keeping it, you know, you keep guiding me and keeping it on focus, because, like I said, brother, as you know, I got a lot of information. When I come on this program, and I also would like to say to anybody who's listening, anything that you hear, don't take my word for it. Do your research. That's why I'm glad Dr. Roger asked me about some sources. But as I always say, with people with access now to the computers and World Wide Web, the information is there. We have to study. But, yes, you're absolutely right. And as a matter of fact, just to give a shout out, he's no longer with us, but there was an African American by the name of Dr. Lonnie Shabazz. His name before he was Lonnie Shabazz was Dr. Lonnie Cross. Dr. Lonnie Cross was born in a little small town outside of Bessemer, Alabama, outside of Birmingham, and then in about 1925, thereabouts. Dr. Shabazz was an early PhD in mathematics in this country. And a lot of the information that I'm given and my inspiration for studying this and being able to go, as I did, down to Texas Southern University for a whole week to go through the mathematics department, the chemistry department, the biology department, the physics department, the computer science department, and to speak and lecture for a whole week on mathematics. My inspiration for studying enough to be able to do that came from Dr. Shabazz. Now, I want to talk about him for a minute, because Dr. Shabazz was responsible for producing more PhDs in mathematics in this country than any other mathematician, a black man from Bessemer, Alabama. And that's why I'm glad you mentioned that for the young people, because he believed that black people had within them the ability to conquer mathematics, to conquer science, to conquer technology, and to conquer engineering. He understood that we could do that, and that Europeans claim that we can't think abstractly, but he understood differently. Now, Dr. Shabazz, just a little bit of information about him. I met him, brought him to Durham, North Carolina, sat with him, but he before he became Dr. Shabazz, he was Dr. Lonnie Cross. He received a PhD from Cornell University, received a master's degree from MIT, and his undergraduate degree was from Lincoln University, which I want to go back to the black colleges, like you like to talk about too a lot, Dr. Rogers, but I'll talk about that in a minute. But he also taught at Atlanta University, and when he first got to Atlanta, there were only two students to graduate with degrees in math. Now, by the end of the year, or 1 year when he was there, it had increased to 8. And then he stayed at Atlanta U from 1957 to 1963. And when he left in 1963, Atlanta University had graduated 109 people with master's degrees in math. And during that period, he also supervised 78 theses, and more than 30% went on to get doctorate degrees. And about 100 people who have doctorate degrees right now in America can trace their degrees back to Dr. Lonnie Shabazz or his students. Now, Dr. Shabazz upset the world of math. He was so well known that even Bill Clinton, when Bill Clinton was president, he gave Dr. Shabazz an award at the White House. Dr. Shabazz shocked the world, though, when he became a member of the Nation of Islam, Dr. Rogers, Bill. He joined Elijah Muhammad after hearing Malcolm X. Okay. And while he was on the faculty at Atlanta U and also at Morehouse, he invited Malcolm to speak to the mathematics club, and he also invited Jane Baldwin. And I didn't think about it when we had the program on Jane Baldwin. So it's so much into this. But anyway, Dr. Shabazz wrote a book called Mathematics at the Dawn, which is very difficult to get. But he's responsible for a lot of the mathematicians that we have in America today. I brought him to Durham. I sat with him and got him on several radio programs. And he is the first person to talk. As we go back into it, he talked about the Ishango bone. And the Ishango bone is a bone that was discovered in the Ishango region in Zaire or in the Congo, and is plotted to be about 8,000 years old. And on that bone, it's very important because it has strikes on the bone, or little scratches on the bone, and it's the oldest scientific document of mathematics being used in the world, the Ishango bone. And there's a European mathematician named de Heisselin who discovered this Ishango bone at the Congo. And then,
give your listening audience some information on where they might get it, and spell that for, could you spell that word for them, so to make sure that if anybody wants to look that up and check that
thanks,
out.
Dr. Thank you, Dr. Rush. Slow me down, brother. I appreciate that. Yeah, put the reins on me.
No,
okay.
That's exciting. Ishango. That's really powerful.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Ishango is spelled I-S-H-A-N-G-O. Ishango. I'll do it again in case people hadn't picked up their pencils. And to those who are tuned in, you might want to call some friends and have them tune into this program tonight, too. Ishango, I-S-H-A-N-G-O. And it was found in Zaire, and it's the evidence of a mathematical system. It was discovered over 8,000 years ago. Mm. And Europeans had not even learned to read or write until about 2,000 years later. They couldn't even read or write, and we had this. Even when you understand geography, and you always like me, Bill, which is tied to say you like geography, which is also a science.
That's right.
I studied geography. When you look at the Earth, and you look at the Earth as it rotates and revolves on its axis at a speed of 1,037 1/3 miles per hour, as it's inclined to the plane of its orbit, 23.5 degrees, when it rotates, that rotation causes day and night. When it revolves, those revolutions cause a year annually. Mm-hmm. And it takes 365 days for the Earth to make a complete revolution around the sun. To be exact, it takes 365 days and 1/6 of another day. And 1/6 of 24 is a fourth. Mm-hmm. That's where you get that leap year, you see. So ancient Africans had discovered and understood this. Mm-hmm. As an example, I'm jumping ahead and I can go back, but ancient Africans in North Africa who had become the custodians, as George G.M. James said in his book, Stolen Legacy, he says that Africans in North Africa actually became, the Africans in North Africa, in Egypt and Southern Africa, were the originators in the Congo, originators of this information. But when the Mohammedan invasions, or the invasion of the Muslims from Arabia, swept across North Africa in the 5th century, many of the Africans in North Africa were called the Moors. Sometimes they were called the Berbers. Mm-hmm. But these Moors became the custodians of the knowledge that Africans in Southern and Northern Africa had already developed. And they began to take this knowledge that I'm talking about now into Spain and Portugal and France and Germany and as far north even as Belgium and to the British Isles. Mm. And the reason I mention, I want to get back to my point, because when we start looking at Moorish knowledge, you will find that there were Moorish scientists and geographers. Even the study of algebra, as I said down in Texas many, many, many years ago, is coming back to me now so plainly and so clearly. There was a professor who was in my audience who was a doctorate in mathematics. He has a doctorate in mathematics. And he stood up when I finished and he said, "Brother, I've never heard any of this information that you're talking about. I want to thank you for coming here to Texas Southern University because you have enlightened me to something I've never known. I never knew where algebra originated. I knew it, I know about it and I teach it, but they don't give us the origins of the things that we teach and that we study and that we know. They don't tell us that algebra is really the shortened title of a book written by the man, by the name of a man, going back to the Moors, a man by the name of Muhammad ibn Musa al-Khwarizmi, who wrote a book on algebra, which was called Algebra wal Muqabalah. I'm not, this is getting a little deep now, and then I'm going to slow down, Bill. We might take a break. But this is where algebra came from. Mm-hmm. But we're not taught about that, and I can spell it when we take questions and answers. I can take time to
just
go
give
over
a
little bit.
Give a resource to that. Do you have a resource?
I'm just trying to make it clear that Africans from North Africa in 708 A.D. invaded Spain and Portugal. They were called Moors.
Right.
And they invaded in 708, but they went in with the armies in 711. This was a Moorish invasion. A lot of people like to give credit to the Arabs, but this invasion in 711 A.D. by Tariq ibn Ziyad in 711 A.D. was a Moorish invasion, an African invasion. And when they went into the cities and built the cities of Granada, of Seville, and Cordoba, and these became Cars, they named Cars after that, the Granada, you remember the Granada, the Grenada, however you want to call it, Seville and the Cordoba, and there was also Barcelona, there was Almeria, and they built these cities using engineering techniques and construction techniques and mathematical treatises that they had learned from the continent of Africa. So they spread it into Spain and Portugal and Europe. And this is what awakened Europeans out of the Dark Ages. They already knew that the world was round. Had sent ships to America from West Africa. I'm leaving North Africa now for a minute. I'm going to the kingdoms of Ghana, Mali, and Songhai. And under Mansa Musa, he had sent ships to America and had gone back to Africa long before 1492.
Okay. You see, all right, now listen, let me do this.
Knowledge.
Let me do this, Dr. Bridges.
Had taken hold in Africa and was beginning to spread around the world. As a matter of fact, we're talking about science, technology, engineering, and mathematics.
Right.
There was a Moorish geographer by the name of El Idris, E-L, one word, Idris, I-D-R-I-S,
right,
who wrote a book, L-E-L, Idris, I-D-R-I-S, who wrote a book in the middle of the 10th century, in the middle of the 12th century, pardon me. It was a book published in the middle of the 12th century. And in that book, there appears this statement, and I've taught it and read it and done lectures on so much, I don't even have to read it. It says in that book, it says that the world, middle of the 12th century now, considering the fact that Ferdinand Magellan did not circumnavigate the globe until 1519, but in the middle of the 12th century, El Idris in his book, it says, the world, or the earth, can't remember exactly which one, is as round as a sphere. The earth is as round as a sphere. Then he says, upon which the waters are adherent and maintained upon its surfaces by natural equilibrium. Then he says what? That the earth has an atmosphere or a layer of air around it. Then he goes on further to say,
Dr. Bridges,
that the
I hate to cut you. I hate to cut you, Dr. Bridges.
Itself.
Dr.
Yes,
Bridges,
sir. Let me finish this.
No, you know,
let
the topic is at the top of the hour, and I gotta take that break. But I wanna before I left, and I know you're good. It's getting good. This is so rich, and I really do apologize for having to cut you off. But it is at the very top of the hour, and I need to take a break. But before I went on that break, I wanted to just quickly go to my brother, the mathematician, Professor at...
Well, let me just finish this one statement that Eldridge... One little sentence, the statement for Eldridge. Let's don't break that one statement up.
Go right ahead.
Okay, he says at the end of the statement, he says that the earth also draws to itself every object that's heavy in the same way a magnet attracts iron. Just wanted to make that point.
Okay.
Which means that Africans already knew about gravity. The earth draws to itself all that is heavy in the same way a magnet attracts iron. So Africans already knew about gravity also. I pick up at that point? All right.
All right. Thank you. This is so rich. I mean, it really is. This is just really powerful. And this information is definitely something that we need to make sure that we retain. Our children can hear it and begin to be a process of our teaching. Just like, I mean, it's so embracing because it covers it all. It covers mathematics. It covers engineering, technology. It covers history, covers geography, covers astronomy, astrology. You know, so it's really an eclectic idea. And so what we're going to do now is take a break. When I come back, I'm going to go right to Brother Lush. Brother Lush, so you can be prepared, I want to ask you about your understanding of historical mathematics, like Dr. Bridges is talking. Then I want to give it back to Dr. Bridges for just a brief, so Doctor, you can kind of read through your notes to make that succinct, because I do want to go to some of the others that I had asked to come on tonight as well. So let's take a quick break, and we're going to come right back with Dr. Bruce Bridges and our panel looking at the idea of STEM and its significance in African children, and whether or not that's something that we need to embrace more as we try to prepare them for the years ahead.
You are beaten. You are. If you think you dare not, you don't. If you'd like to win, but you think you can't, it is almost a cinch you won't. If you think you'll lose, you've lost. For out in this world we find success begins with a person's will. It's all in the state of mind. If you think you're outclassed, you are. You've got to think high to rise. You've got to be sure of yourself before you can ever win the prize. Life's battles don't always go to the stronger or faster man. But sooner or later, the person who wins is the one who thinks he can.
Here's your time for an awakening media lineup. Monday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., African Perspectives, with host Brother Oshi, Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Same time, same place. Continued Monday lineup, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., Acres of Diamonds, with host Brother Jihad Ahmed, 8 p.m. to 9 p.m., Black Therapy Central, host Dr. Mawia Kambom and Sister Nataki Kambom, 9 p.m. till 10 p.m., Conversation Reparations, first and third Mondays. On Tuesday, 8 p.m. till 10 p.m., Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers. On Thursday, 7 p.m. till 9 p.m., Melanin Live with host Lance Jones, co-host Boniswa Ayan. Fridays, 8 p.m. till 10 p.m., Time for an Awakening with creator of Time for an Awakening and host, Brother Elliot, co-hosted by Brother Richard. Saturday, 4 p.m. till 6 p.m., Black Sister Talk with host Wanda Chambers. 7 p.m. till 9 p.m., The Elders of Sankofa. And Sunday, 7 p.m. till 9 p.m., Time for an Awakening, host Brother Elliot and co-host Brother Richard. Check us out.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Thank you, my sisters and brothers. We are back. We are having an extremely rich and very powerful conversation on the subject of STEM, its origin, its usage, and to kind of get an understanding of how it may be applicable today to our children. And Dr. Bruce Bridges has given us a magnificent background discussion to this idea. And we have a group of people in our audience who are also prepared to talk a few things about it. So before I go back to Dr. Bridges and let him wrap up his historical part, I want to ask Brother Lush, kind of move in the middle of it. Brother Lush is a constant listener to our program. We appreciate him so much. He is also a retired professor of mathematics at Dillard University. How are you doing this afternoon, Brother Lush?
I'm doing all right. Good evening, family. Hope everyone is doing well today.
What about all this mathematics? Yes.
Huh?
I said, what about this mathematics, this richness of this topic?
What about this mathematics? I'm going to be real kind of quick because and due with time and with others who are on. As for me, the only sources that I had, everyone, were just two books, just two. One was called The Mathematics in the Time of the Pharaohs. That's Richard Gilling's book. And the other, of course, by the mighty Ivan Van Sertima of Blacks in Science, Ancient and Modern. That's the only two pieces of literature that I had that was lost in Hurricane Katrina that I had to reference from. But this thing we are talking about quickly about science, science is basically knowledge. The archaic definition basically is knowledge of any kind, organized, and through that scientific method that was mentioned earlier. But I like to take it from the angle of failure. Because when you fail at a lot of things, you'd be surprised how much you come to learn. And so that has always been my experiences. I have not always been the brightest or sharpest tool in the drawer. But through the failures, through the anxieties, through not studying, through life, I've learned to fail a lot. And so that's how I came into being, particularly with my undergraduate degree in chemistry. With regards to teaching at Dillard, I don't have a PhD, y'all. I was just teaching freshman and sophomore level mathematics classes. But I was right front and center when students fail. And so as we start to talk about STEM, we need to also consider, what does failure look like? Mm. How do we overcome this thing we call or identify as failure? And how can we learn from it and build from it? So I hope that you can keep this panel together. I really would like to stay with these guys so we could talk more in the future.
That's
and
great.
On other kinds and types of platforms as well. Thank you.
That's great. Thank you so much. And you're right. That's one of the reasons why I played that motivational clipping at our break, talking about the fact that you can succeed if you think you can. If you think you can't, you won't. And so that is a very, very powerful poem that I had learned many years ago as a child. And I think it's so relevant today for our children. So it's interesting you brought that up as an area to look at as well. So thank you so much.
Very good. And all honor and respect to the ancestors, to Marie Daly, the first female African-American PhD in chemistry, and St. Elmore Brady, the first African-American male PhD in chemistry. Thank you.
Beautiful, beautiful. Thank you so much. Okay, Dr. Bridges, I'm going to come back to you. You can kind of wrap it up just a little bit.
I will. And I did, like I told you earlier, I got several people, I think, to tune in, and they may want to say something. So I'm not going to talk too long because I'd like to hear some questions from the audience. And I do hope that they're learning something, because whenever I'm in any situation, and always have been ever since I started studying, if I don't have anything to offer the conversation or anything to give to the listeners, then I feel like I have failed. Based upon what Brother Lush said, I'd like to succeed at least giving out some good information. Now, I did want to mention that he's absolutely right. I just want to reiterate the books that he mentioned, because I have them right in my hand right now. So I was just shocked. Like you always say, Doc, it's amazing how things line up.
Yep,
but one of the very books that he mentioned, two of them, this very two he mentioned, I have them right in my hand right now, and I have not moved out of this recliner that I'm speaking to you in. And one is called Mathematics in the Time of the Pharaohs, that Brother Lush just mentioned, by Richard Gillings, which is a good source. And also, you cannot forget Blacks in Science, Ancient and Modern, by the late brother who has gone on to our ancestors, Dr. Ivan Van Sertima, Blacks in Science. And so I know we have quite a few callers, but what I did want to mention is that and the reason I wanted to make that point on gravity at the end of the statement by the African Moorish scientist Ella Driss is, when we talk about gravity, you walk into a classroom, and what's the first thing the teacher say? She'll say, or he'll say, "Good morning, class. Today we're going to talk about gravity." And it can be a white teacher or a black teacher, because black teachers have been miseducated, and they just simply pass along what they've learned from white universities or white scholars. They'll say, "Good morning, class. We're going to talk about gravity today. Sir Isaac Newton was standing under a tree. An apple hit him in the head. He looked up and said, 'Oh, that must be gravity.'" And this is in the 14th century, if you know anything about Newton. And when you study Newtonian physics, you will find in the works of Isaac Newton himself, he talks about the fact that many of his sources and much of his knowledge came from sources that were before him, like Moorish African sources that he received his information from. So the information is out there if we can just understand it. So we can go on to some other callers if you want to, because I have quite a bit more information, but you like to get to the callers. People are always telling me, "I wanted to say something, like they couldn't get to me, so I don't want to talk too much, Doc." Go ahead.
Okay, we're going to come back to you. No, you stay right there. You stay right there.
Okay.
And I want to just mention to those of our listeners who are on the Internet, as I look at our meter here, I see that we have a large number of people on the Internet. You can call if you have questions or comments. Our area code here is area code 215-490-9832. I repeat, 215-490-9832. So any of you that are on the Internet now, and like I said, I do see several individuals that are there from different parts of the country and even the world. I'm happy to see someone from Mexico and Germany. So if you would like for us to talk or ask a question, by all means, please do so. We thank you so much. Let me go to Brother Pugh. Brother Pugh, how you doing? I'm so glad that you're back with us. hadn't talked with you in a while. You know, I knew you were around, but we always miss you. What are your thoughts about STEM and its usage that in education, particularly as it relates to our African American children?
Well, my thoughts about STEM are negative, and
okay.
And I'll be succinct. But one thing for Brother Lush, one thing in terms of failure, it turns out that you only learn through failure. It's through failure that you're able to realize stuff that you know, assumptions that you made that were incorrect. If you don't fail, you're not made aware of the incorrectness of your assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, so here's what I say succinctly, that that's the critique of STEM. We need an alternative to STEM, and first of all, technology is a crime. That is to say that there are two things about technology. There are technologies that are useful, but there's nothing that technology can do that you can't do without technology. And there are other things that technology does that are harmful. So here, if you've got something which can produce a good result, but you can get that same good result another way, but this thing also produces a bad result, well, that means it's a net negative. Why even have something that has a net negative result if you can do it another way? And by the way, when Dr. Bridges talked about the Sahara, I would argue that I suspect that the reason that that the Sahara became a desert is that agriculture destroys the soil, and that over time, I mean, when you start talking about thousands and thousands of years, you're essentially stripping the soil of its nutrients, and that's what happens when you kill the soil. You know, it becomes sand and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So let me give this succinct critique of STEM in absolute terms. First of all, the reason that STEM is a problem is that the strategy of STEM, in other words, the people who are doing STEM are the big ballers in our society. You know, the big hedge fund guys and whatnot, you know, the big money guys. And what they're interested in doing is producing human beings who can, you remember, one of the things they used to say to the scientists doing when they were dealing with quantum mechanics, they say, how do they put that? Stop thinking and calculate. Or something. Don't think, just calculate. In other words, what they want to do is turn you into a machine to produce certain results for you. So when you start talking about realizing the genius of the black mind, well, you necessarily are not going to be able to realize the genius if what the people are doing is trying to turn you into a machine. They're not interested in what your genius is. They're interested in using you to for a specific purpose. But the second dimension, aside from the strategy, the specific method that is used for STEM is that because you want to control the population, you don't want folks to sort of like the Montessori class where the student goes around and discovers things. What you want to do is give them a well-defined curriculum because you want to control what they know and how they develop. Well, that guarantees that you don't get this kind of flowering of genius of the individual. Mm-hmm. The third dimension is the output. Everybody is talking about technology. Well, technology is just knowledge, and it's true that knowledge is power. But guess what? Power and knowledge, they're not wisdom. What human beings need is wisdom. We don't need knowledge. Knowledge is just a tool. Wisdom gives you the ability to know when to use the tool and how to use the tool. And that leads to the fourth dimension is the effect. We can see right now that we've got an economy where when there was a global financial collapse in 2008, 2009, the people who tanked the economy, these people are billionaires now. So these people destroyed the economy, and we bailed them out, and now they're billionaires. We see the same thing happening now. The same people, the reason there's a pandemic right now is because there's a global economy. If there wasn't a global economy, there wouldn't be a pandemic because even if there was a virus that came in some place, it wouldn't be able to get to the other places because there wouldn't be that kind of interaction. Mm. But guess what? The very people who are responsible for this being a global economy, they're the only people profiting from this global pandemic. So one of the things that you have when you have this kind of sleep STEM model is that you're basically taking, you know, unfortunately, the Urban League, you know, patented this thing, the mind is a terrible thing to waste. No, it's not the mind. It's the heart that's being wasted, because what's happening is that I'm interested to recruit you to essentially be my calculator. I'm not interested in recruiting you to be a human being with wisdom and judgment and a sense of awe in the world. I'm just interested in you being a machine that can do things that right now I can't get artificial intelligence to do. And I'll let it go. Well, just one final thing, just to give a little lick for Dr. Bridges. He may want to elaborate on this. I was just looking at something today, and it was saying that, you know, that there wouldn't be any computers at all if it weren't for African divination systems. I was looking at something on Facebook. Excuse me, not on Facebook, on YouTube, and I can post it on your Knowledge is Power site.
Yeah, good.
And what it talked about is the Bamana sand divination that when the Arabs conquered the African people, one of the things that the Arab mystics did is they took the sand divination ideas back to Europe. They took them with them to Europe. Mm-hmm. Well, in Europe, those ideas, the alchemists use these ideas for geomancy, to sort of predict, you know, what's going on in the world based on the earth.
Right.
Well,
right.
From geomancy, Leibniz, he began to say that instead of using symbols one and one stick is a one and two sticks is a two, instead of using those two symbols, why don't instead we use the symbol one and zero? That is, he digitized, you know, that model. Well, after his digitization of the model, this fellow George Boole came up with something called Boolean algebra. Mm. After Boolean algebra, this mathematician, John von Neumann, came up with the digital computer, or the architecture for the digital computer. So when we have STEM and everything that we have right now that's related to a computer traces back to the African divination system, that is to say, the random number generator that they create, because to have a divination system, you got to have a random number generator. So it begins with that random number generator, and so it's kind of, but what that says, though, in fact, one of the things this mathematician says, his name was Ron Eglash, E-G-L-A-S-H, by the way, he said that when he was asking the Bamana people about their divination system, they didn't want to share it with him, and he offered to pay him, and they didn't want to, you know, accept any money. And then when he showed them that he had the kind of spiritual appreciation for what they were doing that they did, they said, oh, okay, and they initiated him into their tradition, and then they told him. So there's a whole nother way. In other words, STEM doesn't talk about initiating people into a tradition. STEM just talks about, you know, we're just teaching it to the guy, you know, with the most money. In any case, I'll let it go.
Thank you. Good. Thank you so much. And, you know, one of the things I want to quickly add, Dr. Bridges, before you get in there, this embraces so many other disciplines as well. It moves right over into areas of not only just math and technology. It gets into art, music. All of that is a part of this system of things that you're talking about. I remember in terms of looking at historical research is that a lot of times historians will study the architect of a culture in order to understand the nature of the people. And I remember reading a book at some point in time where they were sort of critiquing Baroque art and Baroque architect to help it be understood from the perspective of behavior and attitude as well. So anyway, Dr. Bridges, you want to comment to...
I'm just going to make a brief one because, like I said, you probably got some fresh, brand-new callers that might want to welcome to the program, and I'd like to hear from them. But I did want to say that you're absolutely right about
knowledge crossing over into from one branch of knowledge into another. And that's one thing that the ancients did teach in the ancient civilization, and that is that knowledge is one. We have been taught in the Western world, and I'm also going to relate this back to something Brother Pugh just said. We in the Western world have been taught that if you're a history major, you should have no interest in mathematics. If you're a math major, you should have no interest in drama. If you're a drama major, you should have no interest in language. If you're a language major, you should have no interest in psychology or psychiatry. But the ancients taught and understood that knowledge is one. The root is one. And as Brother Pugh said, that root is the knowledge, but the more important is the wisdom. But the root of knowledge is one, but it then begins to branch out into other forms of knowledge. And that's why when you begin to look at knowledge and you can see oneness in everything, then you can make connections, you can understand relationships, and things will become clearer to you. As Sister Bernice and I were, talking at one time, then you can really begin to connect the dots. When you can see the connections between the Africans in Zimbabwe or Southern Africa and the connections with the kingdoms of Ghana, Mali, and Songhai in West Africa many years later, and then you can see the connection between that civilization and the civilization in the Indus Valley in India, then you can really begin to understand. And this is why we as people, when we study, Dr. Clark talks about this all the time. He says you have to study the white man and what he's put forth. If I had not studied Isaac Newton, I wouldn't have found out about his association with Moorish knowledge and Moorish information. So we have to study Europeans and what they have done, because we will find ourselves in that most of the time. When you study European literature, you're going to find out about Alexander Dumas, first, second, and third. When you study European literature, you're going to understand about Alexander Pushkin in Russia. You see, so knowledge is one. That's a good point I want to make. Knowledge is one. So let's see if we got some first-time callers, Doc. Well, you don't mind doing that, do you?
Okay, well, look, I had a couple of people that I did ask directly to come on.
Oh, okay, okay.
And I want to make sure I get to them. Is Mr. Brother Timothy, could you please mute your phone?
Yes, I will, sir.
I thank you so much. I'm going to get right to you in just a minute. Brother Bourdain, Tommy Bourdain, are you online, Brother Dean? I don't see his number that I know.
Yes, I'm online.
Oh, great. Thank you so much. Good enough. You are working specifically
with
the program.
Hope you got something out of my lecture, too.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry?
I said, I hope you got something out of my lecture, Brother Bourdain. I hope you got something out of what I had to say. That's all.
Yeah. It's a very good lecture. Yes, sir.
Okay. Brother Bourdain, I wanted to ask you, start off, and just kind of tell us a little bit about something that you're doing with young people in that STEM area. In Atlanta. And just kind of give us some of your input and ideas about whether or not STEM works. Mr. Bourdain is a computer specialist. He is an engineer, and I just can't tell you some of the things that he's done in that way. He built the FM low-power radio station out of Milwaukee single-handedly by himself, and he's done things of that nature. So anyway, he definitely can talk about the engineering and the mathematical part. What about the group, the young men that you're working with in terms of that drone study that you're going through with them?
Yes, sir. Well, let me first. I think I'd like to kind of put what I do and what I think about STEM in some kind of context.
Okay.
And the first thing I'd like to say is that, you know, STEM is a buzzword. And so when things become a buzzword, oftentimes they get a little bit perverted. And so I recognize the statements of the previous brother in that regard. But STEM is you know, science, technology, engineering, and math. And we're clear on what science and math is. I mean, that's very, very clear. But engineering is basically just applied science and math. If you can use science and math to do something, it's the engineering that is required to apply those. You know, that's what it is. You apply them, that's engineering.
Okay.
And technology is just the result of engineering your math and science and its outcome. So when you have a body of things that have been engineered through math and science, Now you have a body which is called technology. And so if we put it in that context, it takes a more, it's a more neutral piece. I think as Black folks, we have to take and put things in a context that relate to us so that we don't get caught up in folks' buzzwords. And I know how we are affected by that, because I watch how, as the brother previously indicated, that, you know, you got the big ballers who come in the Black community, they do these STEM seminars and they bring in our children. And the reality of that is that all they want to do is find out who are the folks that have the best potential to fit into what they're trying to do and can be used for their purposes. And the rest of them, they will care less what happens to them. And that's really what happens. So unless we define, determine, and implement things in our own community that encompasses all of the children, the ones that will fit into a corporate environment that the other folks develop and the folks who would rather stay here and build, then we're going to have the kind of situation that we have, where we have folks, you know, a big brain drain, a big brain trust that's being just kind of sucked out of our community.
I like that.
Mm-hmm. So that being said, the theme of this was, does STEM unlock the creativity of our children? And while if it's treated in the context that the previous brother spoke of, I would agree. But if we define it in the context that I've given you, I don't agree. Because in that context, providing our children with math and science and showing them how they can use that to engineer what they think they want to do, then it unlocks the creativity. I think much of the problem that we have in our community and much of the things that get sucked out of our community is because we have folks that have good ideas, but they don't have the resources, the skill set to implement those ideas. And after a while, somebody else that does will take them and run with it. And so that's what we are doing. The last 6 years, we've done coding camps. We've done them in Milwaukee. We've done them in Minnesota, Memphis, and Atlanta. 2 weeks where our objective is not to teach young people how to really be coders per se, but how to use code to control things, which is, again, applying what they learn to come out with outcomes to let them know that they can take their creativity and what they learn and have outcomes. The thing that I'm working on now, which is what Brother Rogers indicated, is the drone project is what I call it, just kind of loosely. Mm-hmm. And basically what we're really doing is we started in Atlanta, where we're looking at four other cities, maybe five, where we'll start a small club with twelve teams, mm-hmm. Boys and girls on each team, or equal number of boys and girls. And we'll build drones, we'll race drones, and we'll learn how to monetize and learn, but through the principles of building and racing, we'll learn how we can modify and monetize what we're doing. And then use that as the basis to expand to other things. When you think about the idea of failure as a means of learning, you ain't gonna fail no more than you will with trying to fly a drone. You're gonna tear that thing up. And because we built it, we can rebuild it or fix it and put it back together and put it back again. Mm-hmm. Figure out what we did wrong in the process of flying to get a little bit better at that, and figure out what it is we may need to do to make a better drone, make it run better, make it fly better, and those kinds of things. So, again, for me, it's the experience of taking math and science, engineering and technology, and looking at those things, manipulating those things, and then teaching our children how to make those things in their own image so that they aren't trying to create another Google, or they're not trying to create another Microsoft. They're trying to create something that may have some similarities to Microsoft or Google or something else, but it has those things that are inherent in them that draws up certain things from them that are friendly and good for community that we can put out there.
All right. And real quickly, Mr. Bourdain, would you mind? Now, I know that you're kind of doing what I call the George Washington Carver thing. You're building a bus. You've taken a bus, and you've gutted it out, and you put computers in there. Can you explain that project a little bit? I mean, I'm just
Well, that's the whole idea, and that's something that we're going to do. And so we've got people that are interested in us doing it for them in several cities as well. And basically, the idea was that we took like a small tour bus. It wasn't. It probably would hold 30 people, you know, some 30 people. And we gutted the bus, and we put in tables, chairs, and it's not a passenger bus, but it's a mobile classroom. So we put air conditioning in it. Next year, we hope to put solar panels on it, but we got generator, air conditioning, the seats, we got multiple computers, the lighting, and a lot of equipment to do projects. So it's our idea to be able to take things to the community that we can teach our children. And in the meantime, we have other organizations that are saying, well, you know, we got literacy programs we'd like to do. We got other things. So it can be a traveling education facility for various disciplines, and it's something that we control. It's not a question of trying to pay somebody rent every month. You know, we can keep gas in it and keep it running. We can keep it moving, and that's not going to be a difficult thing to do.
Again,
it comes back down to having those things that you control. You control the context. You can control every aspect of it, and that way you can maintain it, and it will be sustainable.
That's powerful. That is really powerful. I know when you first told me about that, I was really amazed at that, what that could do for young people, and they are also helping you build that in some way. Is that correct?
Yeah, we have people that are working with that right now.
Right.
So yeah, and as we make it, we have them participate on every level that we can, because everything they learn is valuable.
Okay, let me ask you. I don't know if you're at this point yet, but if anybody wanted to get some more information about that and to reach out to you, is there an email that you can give us that maybe they could email you and with questions or talk about that? Because this is very valuable that you talk about.
Uh-huh. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. The email they can contact me at is kwojwo@gmail.com.
Okay, one more time.
kwojwo@gmail.com.
So anybody that would like to find out more about this magnificent project that he's doing with, first of all, helping young people to construct and build drones, as well as this project with the technology and coding by using the bus and going from location to location to do that, just hit Mr. Bourdain. Bourdain, B-O-R-D-A-I-N, Tommy Bourdain. Thank you so much, Brother Tommy. Appreciate it.
I appreciate you, brother.
Okay, all right. Brother Timothy, you said you had, now you're teaching in the Philadelphia school system. Are they using STEM where you are?
Sir, no, they're not. But listen, right, I'm driving, and I don't know if there'll be no disturbance in the background. So can you come back in about 10 minutes?
Okay, I will do. I will do that. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Let's go to, I didn't know, Brother Griffin, I know you had kept putting some excellent points on the board. Did you want to talk about some of those, or did you just want to just listening right now? Okay, I guess you're just listening right now. Let's go to let's see if we can open up. I've got a caller here from Richmond, Virginia, 804-495. Caller, would you like to say something or ask a question? Richmond, Virginia, 804-495. Okay, just listening. That's fine. Chicago, 773-874. Are you listening? Would you like to say something?
I would like to say something.
Oh, yes. Good. How are you doing, Dr. James?
Hi, yes. This is Dr. Janine James, and I'm enjoying listening to this wonderful history lesson. And we've been talking among black physicians about the STEM programs and pipeline programs, but I think we are missing the point. And STEM is simply another example of racism and disrespect of black people. There is no interest in preparing our children for careers in science, technology. There's no interest. This is not what this is about. Because if it was, then we would have more of us in these positions already. We're teaching people things that are being taught by people often who are not particularly interesting, who don't particularly have a command of the subject,
right.
And it's not interesting to the children. And the children have so many other things. They don't know whether they're going to live from going to get a snack and if they're going to make it back home. So it's hard to expect somebody to focus in the depth that one needs to spoke to learn some of these subjects. That's assuming if somebody really wanted to teach you. And one of the wonderful things about having become a physician and advancing in that is you begin to recognize that when you see people teaching various things or teaching various groups of things, you recognize that this is garbage. It is nonsense. It is subjects that will prove to be irrelevant in the care of patients or in engineering. And so what we've done is created just another way for white people to make money by building schools, by putting signs on there, changing the names of things. But it really is not what we think that it is. And I listened to about the bus being created. We should not have to do things like that. There's plenty of money that's being allocated, but not us.
Okay.
We're looking for volunteers to help us learn, but to teach our children. But the money is already there. Now the question that I'd like to hear you discuss is, what are we going to do to insist that we have people who are teaching our children something that's relevant to keep their mind interested?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to stop there, but that's a thought to put on your mind.
That's a good point. Good point. Very good. Thank you, Dr. James. Dr. James is also the host and coordinator for the Elders for the Sankofa Council from Milwaukee Saturday program at 6 o'clock. So dynamic discussions. Brother Les, let me just quickly ask you, would you have a comment about what Dr.
Hello?
Yeah, we're here. I don't know what that was, where that's coming from. No telling, but someone's phone had done something. Brother Lush, did you understand me? I wanted you to comment because you are in the engineering as well as in academia. What type of things could be done? What type of things could be done in order to answer Dr. James's question? So, would you like to take that, Brother Lush?
Yeah, but not now. I would like to hear other people, and hopefully Dr. James and I can converse later. I'm actually in environmental chemistry, so that's another animal. But I like to hear other people's comments.
Okay.
And hopefully, Brother Jane, Dr. Rogers, if you could keep all of us together as a group, that would be great too as well.
I will. I wanted to indicate to our listeners that are on the internet, what I'm going to do is we are going to go over a little bit, but we will lose the internet group at 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock Eastern, 8 o'clock Central. We will be able to talk with you at the end, but right now we're going to stop at we'll stop the internet at 8 o'clock, and then we'll pick back up with our group, which is on the telephone, and we'll continue our conversation for about 15 minutes. So those of you who are online, the telephone number is 215-490-9832, 215-490-9832. So around 5 to 8, if you'd like to get off and come on the phone, and we are going to continue this conversation just a little bit more. And we'll be there with you. So, Dr. Bridges, would you like to...
Oh, you forgot about me, Doc.
No. I've got. You said you wanted other people to ask questions, didn't you?
Yeah, they're not talking, though. You went to Richmond, my friend from Richmond. They didn't talk. I don't know. Yeah, I thought they were going to say something. You got a 202 call. I told the sister in Washington, D.C. You got a 202 on the line? Yeah,
no,
I bet you don't, do you?
No, we don't. We got a call from Henderson, North Carolina. Would you be interested in adding to this conversation, or are you just listening?
Just listening right now. Enjoying it. Very.
Okay. Thank you so much. Okay. Brother Timothy, are you settled now? Do you want to ask a question now, Brother Timothy? Brother Timothy, are you settled? I know you said you wanted to park your car.
Dr. Rogers.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Okay, go right ahead. Okay. Go right ahead.
Now, right. I'm going to say to you, sir, I love this program. And in 1994, 95, 96, and 97, at a conference on education and discourse, it was a Booker T. Washington, Du Bois, Marcus Garvey conference. And Dr. Lonnie Shadbas was teaching there at the time. And Dr. Shadarkasaw was our president. And I invited him to my conference. And I couldn't wait to get a hold of him because, you know, Malcolm speaks of him in his autobiography. And, you know, each person that we know this famous that came out of the Nation of Islam and studied the Messenger teaching all had a certain gift. Ali's gift was self-defense, without a doubt. Malcolm was a great debater and knew politics. Louis Farrakhan was a gifted natural-born speaker. Dr. Lai Shabazz was a brilliant mathematician. See, in the Nation of Islam, you have the 120 degrees, you have the lessons on ether, you have the history of the original man and woman, but you also have something called the problem book. And Dr. Lai Shabazz was one of the messengers students who understood it. So I'm telling you that when Dr. Bruce Business talked about Dr. Lion Shabazz, I've been his president. He was at my conference, and that was a wonderful thing. But there were people who mentored me in my career of teaching. I started elementary school and went to secondary education. And I had a professor, his name was Professor Burton. He taught at Temple University in the pastor program. A good brother, smart brother. He taught English, but he said, Tim, just don't start with the English that's taught in the public school system. He said, Tim, I'm going to teach you to teach the 8 parts of speech. He said, I'm going to teach you etymology, where you understand the word, the prefix, the suffix, you know, how to build the sentence, the importance of the sentence. Or I came across a professor of mine named Dr. William T. Johnson. He's dead now. He taught at Cheney for 20 years, and he taught at Lincoln for 20 years, and he ended up at Penn. He died teaching. So I'm like, the people who are interested in educating, we got to go to the source. We have to go to the original people of the planet, and we got to get to the root of it. Because what Dr. Josh gave me, he gave me the Pythagorean theorem, and he put it in a puzzle form. I still have him. He had built blocks of Pythagoras. He even made a poem up for me to give to him. So we got to, when we do our STEM, what they call STEM, we have to go right to the root and bring it right to the base in order for our students to excel over other folks. Because remember,
We are the original people of the planet. And everything that was built here first, everybody copied what we had. So I appreciate the show. It's wonderful.
Great. Thank you so much. Thank you. Okay. Richmond, Virginia, 804-495. Did you want to say something again? I think I might have asked you before. Are you just listening? Okay. I don't have a number. I have a last name. Last name is Belinga. Belinga, would you like to comment, or are you just listening right now? Okay, just listening. Let's see. We wanted. I did ask the Henderson call, North Carolina. So, Dr. Bridges, I think I got to all your folks as possibly on here, no, and they are choosing not to say anything right now. But we've got some more time, so why don't you, Dr. Bridges, pick up some of the information that you wanted to give us that you haven't done so as of yet. Dr. Bridges?
Okay, I had my mute on. Right. I was about to say, I'll do that. I'll pick right up. But I guess a lot of them listen on the computer and don't want to say anything on the telephone. Yeah. But anyway, I did want to mention something that the sister said. Where was she from? She said Chicago. You know who I'm talking about.
Dr. James.
Right. She mentioned something about what how we could put this into some form so that it could be beneficial to us as opposed to STEM. And I agree with her 100%. And that reminds me of, and to tie this right in with what we're talking about, there was an architect from Wilmington, North Carolina, by the name of Robert Robinson Taylor. And he was recruited by Booker T. Washington. As a matter of fact, they made one of those memorial stamps on him. And he was recruited by Booker T. Washington. He actually was an architect, and he designed the science building at Tuskegee, which was Thatcher Hall. He also designed the chapel at Tuskegee, and he designed the Oaks at Tuskegee, which was Booker T. Washington's home. And he was, I think, we went to MIT. He's the first black man to graduate from MIT with a degree in architecture. We're talking about architecture and engineering, which is a part of STEM, staying right on the subject. And Robinson Taylor and Booker T. Washington said that they drew that inspiration from MIT's model, and they brought it to Tuskegee. And Taylor, the architect, made a speech in 1911, and in that speech he said that what we're going to do here, and the speech was done before U.S. Congress, he said we're going to illustrate the rigorous ideas, approaches, and methods that Tuskegee adopted from MIT. But now this is very important. This is the part I wanted to say applies to what the sister said. He says, but we want to apply what we've learned at MIT within the context of a black educational institution. We as people have to take whatever it is that we get from these white folks in their schools, when we get their degrees, when we get their training, when we get their craftsmanship, when we learn anything from them, we need to take it and bring it back and apply it to our own people in some form or fashion to help us with it, and not to become, and tying back into what Brother Pugh said, not to become technical robots, but to become human beings and to take that knowledge and uplift, and going back again to what he said, not from the head, from the heart, but take that knowledge and apply it to our people and to raise us up with what it is we've learned. As an example, when Booker T. Washington was the president at Tuskegee Institute, he made sure that he hired all black faculty.
Right.
He did
sure
that
did.
On purpose. Sure there did. Were all black faculty people at Tuskegee. And he did that because he wanted to extend to the students at Tuskegee the experience of black leadership. Because out of them seeing black leadership and hearing black leadership, they themselves would come out and become leadership, I mean, become black leaders in their own community. You see, So that's another example, and that's why I agree 100% with what Brother Pugh said, and also with what the brother Bardeen said about what he's doing. Because when you look at Silicon Valley, and when you look at what's happening out in the high tech areas of California, these people are controlling population, they're controlling our minds, controlling our thinking. But we can take their techniques and use them to uplift ourselves as a people. Another example.
Let me just say this real quickly.
Colonialism.
Dr. Bridges, hold on.
When you look at colonialism, when African countries became independent in the late 1950s, Ghana in 59, 1960, most of the African leadership were trained at missionary schools. Nkrumah was trained at a mission school in his little small village, Assisi, in Ghana. Julius Nyerere was trained at a missionary school. Robert Mugabe, Joshua Nkrumah, they were trained at missionary schools. Maurice Bishop was trained at a missionary school in Grenada before he went to school over in England, which was also another adjunct of a missionary school. But all of these men that I mentioned were trained by white folks, as we're trained in this white thing called STEM, and to become technologized, and to become anti-human, and to become robots. They took the knowledge that they learned to help uplift their people and to become independent. So we can take what the white man has, but let's use it for our own benefit as a people. That's the point I want to make. Going back to what brother, and that, so
Dr.
I wanted
Bridges,
to mention to,
Dr. Bridges, I
gotta
cut,
Robert.
Dr. Bridges, I got to cut you off a minute because we're going to have about 15 minutes left, and I need to let our internet audience know that they can still continue in this conversation. But if you want to call us at 215-490-9832, 215-490-9832. So those of you who are listening to the internet and you want to still be a part of this, you can do so. And all as well, our podcast part, the archives, will also carry that 15-minute conversation, because this is a rich discussion, and I want to get much. As you see, Dr. Bridges is excited about this, and he is just going through, so I wanted to do that again. So to our internet listeners, in a few minutes, we are going to you'll be off the air, and we would like to be able to continue this discussion. We're going to do so, in terms of the telephone. So you can call us at 215-490-9832. Okay, Dr. Bridges, I'm going to come back to you now, but we got about 15 minutes left. I want to ask this one question before you start. One of the things that I noticed in reference to what Dr. James was indicating about the training, the land-grant colleges and their creation was ideally supposed to be based around doing that. That's why a lot of them have that A&M, A&T,
A&I,
and all of that. Is that what are your comments about that? Because I know very clearly Tuskegee had it, and it was not a land grant. Tuskegee had all kinds of different science, mathematics programs there, and even up to today they still have that. So what about the land-grant colleges that ended up going to some of the SBC, black traditional black colleges?
Well, like you said, Tuskegee started off pretty much as agricultural institution, and not just agriculture, but it also, by agriculture being a science, it expanded into science and mathematics and engineering and chemistry. And it also, as you said too, it was funded by Andrew Carnegie and funded by Rockefeller. And Booker T. Washington appeased people in the North based on what he was doing, and he also had that whole code of ethics and that religious training that he put in there. And he was very shrewd with a lot of things that he was doing, but a lot of those colleges, those A&Is, A&T, what else, A&T, A&I, and A&M, right, okay, those schools were basically schools that were they were kind of technically oriented. And as a matter of fact, since you mentioned Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois, which is another subject, he did not agree with what was going on with those schools.
No, he didn't.
He was more for, those NC Central. He was more for the St. Augustine colleges, and he was more for the Morehouse and the Spelman. He was more for the liberal arts universities, as you know. Because he says that the liberal arts would doing what Booker T. Washington was doing would only make us second-class citizens by training people to be architects and engineers and to be craftsmen and to make the bricks that they build the buildings with, which they did at Tuskegee. The architect, Robert Robinson Taylor, was the architect, but most of the men on the campus of Tuskegee, they made the bricks in their own kilns, and then they also constructed the buildings that he, as an architect, design.
Right.
The same thing happened to Julian Abel, who designed the whole west campus of Duke University in this city of Durham, North Carolina. The same Julian Abel that designed the administration building at Duke University. He also designed Cameron Indoor Stadium, where Coach K, Krzyzewski, brings all that money in with the black basketball players. Going back to our earlier program, bring on the reparations they owe us. And then when you look at the same thing that happened in Brother Timothy's hometown, the Philadelphia Library downtown, the Philadelphia Museum, and the architecture, that was designed by Julian Abel, the same architect that did the design for Duke University, science, technology, engineering, mathematics, architecture. And so it goes on and on. They owe us for what we've done. But we as people have to take what it is that we learn, and like what you're doing here on this program, try to have people on here, but it has to be from a perspective that shows our people and contribution that we have made, because this inspires the young people, like the sister said, out of Chicago, and that's what I try to do in all my lectures. If I talk about anything, as one brother said, if Bruce Bridges talked about something, it's going to be black. It's going to be about black folk. I mean, that's the only way I know to go. And that's what Booker T. Washington did in his own way. Du Bois was a little different, which is another subject. But anyway, got in the last minute callers there that wanted to make some comments or what?
I got you. Just hold on. I want to come back to you, brother, to ask the question. What about the some of when like, for instance, North Carolina area, and you were there, so you know the politics of that, was decided to make that area a research triangle. And you had the big corps like Burroughs Wellcome, Glasgow Klein, Monsanto, IBM, Northrop Telecom, and all of them were there in this little small area. What is it, about 400 acres maybe of land?
And they put it there, and that's one reason that expressway was put through Durham that destroyed the Hayti section, the black section, Little Africa section of Durham, North Carolina. They put that expressway through there so that people working in that research triangle that you just mentioned, the Monsantos and the IBM and Biogen, the chemical plants and all that, so they could get to and from work through the expressway in a much easier, more efficient fashion. They built the expressway and destroyed our community. And that's why what Brother Pugh was saying and Brother Bourdain was saying is true. Whenever they're doing something, they're doing it for their benefit. They're not doing it for us. They will say that we're going to rebuild Hayti and give you some better buildings and relocate you. But no, that's not what it was about. It's about making it better for them. By the same token, when Carnegie and Rockefeller and some of the other Phelps Stokes funds and the money that they put into those land-grant colleges, they were putting the money in the land-grant colleges so the black people graduating could come out and be better slaves for them, to work for them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it's always about. You best believe that they're never doing it for us and for our benefit as a people. So we have to do as Mugabe did. We have to do as Sankara did, as Nkrumah did, when they became independent. Take whatever it is from that school, so we do go to their schools, but use it for the benefit of our people.
So now, but going back to Dr. James's question, how then do we change this around? What does community...
I think, you know, I'm glad you said that question. I think we as people, in the same ways that we march and protest for Black Lives Matter and vote on city councils and county commissioners and school boards, we have to let our voices be heard and let people know where we pay taxes, that this is what we want. And we really do not do enough of that. Let me give an example. I won't call any names, but this is a personal thing that happened. There are certain people in this area, because of Bruce Bridges and his perspective, and they know what his perspective is going to be, regardless of whether or not he has the degrees, regardless of whether or not he has the information, but they don't want me in positions at these universities. They don't want what I'm going to bring. Right. Going back to what the sister said in Chicago, we as people have to petition and walk and march and boycott. And it reminds me of what Nathan Hare did and what other people did in the 60s when they wanted Black studies. We have to stand up, might have to take over some buildings. We might have to invade some classrooms and shut some things down until we can get to the point to we have to. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has, and it never will.
That's right.
We have to agitate and agitate.
Okay.
Hey, brother. Hey, how you doing? This is Brother Jones. How you doing, fellas?
Fine, good. How you doing?
Out of New Bern.
Hey, yeah, from New Bern. How you doing?
Doing great. How you doing?
All right, then just to allude to what Brother Bridges was saying and what the question you asked him, as some of the brothers from academia were just talking about along the program here, talking about what we do, what they were saying, they spoke on a lot of names of good brothers, and some of the brothers there were well-versed and well-educated into what they were doing. You came up with a lot of brothers' names that had doctorates before their names, but nobody spoke of Imhotep, a brother that came way back from ancient Egypt.
I won't even say
ancient Egypt. We talk of Africa and the ancient Egypt, but we were Kemetic people. But nobody spoke of Imhotep, a brother that studied hydraulics and math and all of the sciences that you guys have talked about the whole time. So when we're going to really rise to the occasion and rise to the level of our being, we got to go back to the foundation of our knowledge and our self. We've lost the knowledge of self. So if we're going to get back and get strong, let's go back to our real foundation.
I'm
going to leave it like that. So Brother Bridges, and you, brother, both of you guys talk about, you know, things from that perspective. And you guys go from there. I just wanted to share that with you, brother.
Thank you so much.
And you
Thank
guys
you so much.
Take it from
and
there.
And listen, I want to get in touch with you during the week to talk about that project we and I talked about. I want to let you know that. Okay?
Okay, man. Look forward to it, fellas. But you guys take that conversation from there.
Okay.
And the other people can jump in on it, too, if you'd like. I'm a communicator, brother. Y'all go from there.
I guess. Brother Lush?
Yes, Dr. Rogers.
Yes, sir. Go right ahead.
You know something? You know, Dr. Bridges, I wish we could sit together and have coffee because of the fact that what you just suggested, sir, we need not do. We need not try to boycott and rise up and march. We need to do this internally amongst ourselves. Mm-hmm. All of you all who have the knowledge, skills, and abilities, look, we all have had some European to sign our diplomas to some degree or another. We all have had that. At what point do we amongst ourselves establish an evaluation, a criteria amongst ourselves without the assistance of people outside of us? And when do we do that? Look, the best honor you could have is an honor coming from someone who looks like you. And so we got to get out of that. If there's a SACS accreditation agency that goes around and has the criteria established on how colleges and universities should conduct themselves and the business that we could do that same thing for ourselves. Now, we got to get away from them. We got to be able to say, look, according to these accredited, these valued individuals amongst us, they can determine for us. It will be our Nguzu Saba, our Chukwuji Chakulia, not the approval, acceptance and approval of someone outside of us. That's all of that I asked. And I remember asking that question some time ago. At what point can we create within ourselves the kind and type of criteria that would be able to elevate us from within? Just a comment. Thank you so very much.
It. Okay. Let me go to some of the motherhood. Let's go to the womb of our community. Sister Makita, would you want to add to this discussion, or are you just listening tonight?
I'm just listening because I tuned in kind of late, but it's just so very interesting. I've been enjoying and learning from everyone who's spoke within the last few minutes. And I really do like the fact that we do need to go back and talk about Imhotep, you know. So I really appreciate what the brother said, because I watched a movie the other day, and it was about the mummy. And they were making the mummy, who, you know, like, he was evil, and he had fallen in love with this white woman, and he wanted to marry this white woman. And I said, and they showed it was depicting Imhotep. And I said, you know, this is a dog. This really is foul that, you know, that someone whom we should be admiring, that they're going to make cast him in a role that he's evil and that he's, you know, reincarnating and coming after this white woman. So I thought it was very interesting how, you know, how they shape the mind and our thoughts. And then I saw something the other day, another movie, and I shook my head. It was about these kids that found this secret passage. It was like a pyramid shaped like a triangle. And they went millions and millions of years back and said, oh, well, we had knowledge. Now, these were all white kids, blonde hair, blue eyes. We were the ones that had knowledge that we came to Earth. We built the Sphinx, and then we left. And now the world is messed up, and now we've got to come back and change the world and start all over with a new generation. I just thought, wow, just, you know, I mean, it's like they're so busy trying to change our history, our narrative, our story. And so if we don't really tell our story, if we don't teach it, then, you know, we're just lost,
right,
because,
right.
You know, okay, I won't talk too long, but I do appreciate that we have to we do have to fight right now, not fight. We do have to put some force, some demand on what we want our new this new political regime to do. We do. We just can't sit back and say, okay, they're going to take care of everything. So I like what Dr. Bridges is saying as well, but I'm going to get off and let you all continue.
Okay, thank you. Sister Ayan, how are you tonight? You have any questions? You just listening?
I want to make a quick comment.
Okay.
Greetings,
brothers
and sisters. Bruce, you put it down. You really taught tonight.
Yeah, you always does.
Yes, and Dr. Rogers, I have to thank you. This has been a beautifully educational process this evening.
Right.
I loved every minute of it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, I want to say that, and just that, you know, whatever we teach, it must be African-centered, and we haven't learned everything yet. You know, Imhotep may not be the first physician or all that he was. We're still learning.
Yes,
so we're still in process, and all of it is relevant. The last thing, one of my teachers taught me that in African culture, there's no right or wrong or good or bad. So that way we can put all the information together and extract what works for people, what works for us.
Beautiful.
But anyway, thank you all. Asante Sana. Wonderful program.
All right. Thank you. I wanted to also, I don't want to overlook Brother Lush's desire that he has. He says he wants to, I know we can't get together and have coffee, but he wants me to, wants to keep this group working together, and I'm willing to do that in a way, since I do have access to the phone numbers, and if there's anybody that objects, you know, I think we're talking about Brother Pugh, Brother Timothy, and there is a point that Brother Lush wants to definitely talk with you, Brother Timothy, and see if we can get support. And obviously, Dr. Bridges, keep you in the loop on this, and any others that might want to join this, you know, outside of the radio broadcast, because we're going to do this again, and we're going to talk about Blacks in Science using books like Van Sertima and some of the other work that they've done, because this is an educational process. This think tank discussion is education, and we're hoping that, as Dr. Bridges said, that people are learning. They're learning something from what we're saying. So I don't want to let you know, Brother Lush, I'm not overlooking what you said. I'm going to work on that, take some minute to get that together, and very much pull our group together and continue the discussion outside of the, you know, the Black Reality Think Tank. We can do that as well. Okay, Dr. Bridges, we are, got about 5 more minutes. I'm now going over to 15 minutes, so because this is good. So why don't you kind of wrap it up with what you want to say? I think we've opened up. We do have one other brother that someone called from Atlanta, 404-447. I don't know if you're listening. Would you like to say something? 404-447, Atlanta, Georgia. Okay. I guess
hello, brother. This is Monifa. I just wanted to log in to listen to the rest of the program because Tommy got cut off.
Oh, yeah. How are you? Your husband did a wonderful job. How you doing?
I'm good. I'm so happy to be on and listening to everyone's great comments.
All right. Thank you so much for calling. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. So Dr. Bridges, you want to pick up with get ready to wrap this up?
Yeah, okay. It's like you said earlier, it's just so much because just to try to answer a couple of people here, brother that called from New Bern with Imhotep, yes, that's another whole discussion, and I didn't just leave Imhotep out because I know quite a bit about Imhotep, but it's so much information when it comes to the culture and the heritage of African people that we're going to always leave something out when we only got a couple of hours to discuss it. So no disrespect to Brother Imhotep, but he was considered, as the brother said, a multi-genius, and even doctors in the American system today, they utter the Hippocratic Oath, which is an oath to the Greek Hippocrates, who they consider, as I was talking about earlier, the true father of medicine. Hippocrates, the white man who studied down in Africa, in Egypt, and but it was really Imhotep who was the father of medicine, and he was called, before he was called Imhotep, he was called Aesculapius, and it was always, he made statements that the doctors who've gotten their medical degrees, they take the oath to Aesculapius, which is the oath that they will try to do what they possibly can to help in the healing of humanity. That's the oath that they take, but oftentimes, as we well know, they're racist. And to try to turn and stand on our topic again, tying into architecture and engineering, there was a sister by the name of Beverly Harris, who was an architect from Topeka, Kansas, but she is responsible for designing several of those buildings in Chicago, and Chicago is known for those tall, girded structures with the glass-like architecture of the buildings downtown. It's a black woman who is responsible for designing those.
That's right.
And not only was she this is, like I said, very, very, very good for young people, now children, or anybody to inspire them. Not only did she work in Chicago, but then she went to Brazil and did some design or some architectural designs for the capital of Brazil, which is Brasilia. She even designed the building that the vaccine came out of, that we, that, what we call the company, Pfizer. The Pfizer company, she designed the building for the Pfizer headquarters in Brazil in the late 1960s. She also designed Ford Motor Company's headquarters in Brazil, and she designed the Kodak company in Brazil. This black woman who went to Washburn University in Kansas and then went to school, I mean, then went to Chicago. And she said she was inspired by another African-American female architect. So as you said from the beginning, come on with the reparations. Come on with the reparations. I mean, they owe us. And just today, it came on the news, too. You made me think about when you talked about Bunny Wailer. Another news item that we talked about, I think, on this program, the plantation in Raleigh, North Carolina, the Duncan Cameron Plantation, the Cameron Village was named for, and the right, Cameron Plantation right, that intermarried with the Benningham Plantation that became the Stagville Plantation. They just changed Cameron Village's name just to the village today. They didn't put a name of a black person, but they did take the racist Cameron name off of that building. Mm. And another news item that's out, too, that relates to what we're talking about, there's a movie that many of our listeners can probably find. I saw it on television last night. It was about the Wilmington race riot of 1898. It just came out. And it talks about the first coup d'etat in America when white people took over the city, which was predominantly black, businesses, which was predominantly black, of Wilmington, North Carolina. It's called We Have Taken a City. And it's actually called Red Cape. The name of it is Red Cape. But that was on last night, too, and I wanted to mention that.
Is that the one that the brother did? There's a brother did one.
Yeah, I don't. You know what? I saw the credits on the end. I think a white boy actually did this. Of course, I think a white boy put it together, but it was called Red Cape. But I did view it last night. But it's about the Wilmington race riot of 1898. So they destroyed Wilmington. They destroyed Eaton, Florida. They destroyed Tulsa, Oklahoma. They destroyed Jackson Ward in Alabama. They destroyed 2nd Street in Richmond, Virginia. Destroyed Hayti in Durham, North Carolina. Destroyed Boley, Oklahoma. They've destroyed everything we've built for them and built for ourselves. They destroyed it. So bring it on. Bring it on. Bring the reparations on. They owe us.
Dr. James,
in order for us to get it all back and to keep it out in front of their minds, we must recapture the African mind.
Dr. James, before we close out, I want to quickly ask you, you've had the medical training, and you've gone through that process. Is Imhotep mentioned in medical schools that you were a part of and attended?
Where I first heard that name is part of the letterhead of the Cook County Physicians Association, and they have an image of Imhotep, and they give you a little information. That's the first I ever heard that.
Wow.
Not in medical school.
Okay.
And see, that's by design.
Right.
Exactly. Exactly. By design. They're going to leave us out of everything.
All right, Dr. Bridges, you got 2 minutes. Dr. Bridges?
Oh, okay.
2 minutes.
Well, I'm just about finished. I enjoyed the program, enjoyed our callers, and hopefully we can do it again and continue because I really was just getting started, and hopefully we can come back and do it again.
Okay. I love it. Thank you so much. You bring in a lot of energy to this conversation. I appreciate you. You know I do. Very hopefully we will visit this again. And Brother Lush, I want to
Now since we got, I did want to mention, I meant to go back to Brother Lush. Now, what Brother Lush said is absolutely correct, and I agree with him 100% because I have taught when the American Muslim Muslims under Waqf Dean Muhammad had a school in Sedalia, North Carolina, on the campus of the school in Sedalia, Palmer Memorial Institute, started by a black woman out of Warrenton, North Carolina, Dr. Charlotte Hawkins Brown. When she was deceased, the school went down, and Waqf Dean Muhammad bought that school
right,
and put a college there, and I taught on that campus. And that was a private school, an independent school, and I think that's what Brother Lush was talking about, doing it ourselves, and he's right about that. But as long as we're going to be a part of these institutions and we're going to spend our money, our students, if we're going to spend our money with these schools going to Harvard, Yale, UNC, A&T, all these schools, then we need to have some say-so in terms of what goes on in those classrooms. I know what Brother Lush is saying. I agree with him 100%, but we still need to have some say-so as to what goes on if we're going to support these schools in any way, in any way, and we do support them because our children go there. We go to the dances, we go to the football games, the basketball games. So we should have some say so. If not, just come out and don't even support them at all.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much, Sister Evers. I don't know if you want to say something about the continuation of your workshop on Friday. Did you want to mention that at all in our closing hour here?
Oh, thank you. Yes, please join us. 7 p.m. Central Time this Friday. We're having a lecture discussion led by our presenter, Dr. Rogers. And it is, let's see, we can send them a flyer, right, Doc?
Yes, I do.
Oh, good. I'm glad she announced that. Right.
Okay.
Yeah. It was wonderful last week, so we want to continue. We have the continuation on Friday, 7 p.m. Central Time. And I don't know how we're going to get the link to you, but call Dr. Rogers.
Can you give your phone number? Maybe they can call you and give you an email address where you can send them the link or something like that. I don't know.
Sure. You could call me at 414-573-1295.
Say it again.
414-573-1295.
Okay.
414-573-1295.
Beautiful. Thank you so much.
Well, now, folks, tell them what you're going to be discussing, too, Doc, on Friday night.
I got to close it out. I'm sorry. But we will. We'll definitely try to tap in this. We're getting ready to go into the 9:30 hour, so I definitely got to close this out. Thank all of you for your attendance, for staying with us for a little while longer. Dr. Bridges has been phenomenal in terms of what he gave us and the information that he's brought forward. We appreciate him. And then the comments from Brother Pugh out of Baton Rouge, Brother Tommy Bourdain, with that wonderful project he has. It's amazing. If you get a chance to email him, Brother Lush, what you're talking about doing, and Sister James, what you were talking about, some of the answers were, that project has that. And it's just that we got to support him and give him a chance to spread that around to more places. Right now he's Milwaukee, and he's as he said, I think he's doing some things in Mississippi. He's doing some things in Atlanta, obviously. But he needs to go. He needs to come to Montgomery. He's very close to you over there, and Brother Lush, and some other places, and work some of those things. And that bus that he has that he talked about is just magnificent. So anyway, thank you. We'll be back here again next Tuesday, same time, 7 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Eastern. We thank you again for your support. Love you. Have a great week, and be safe.
Good morning, evening, friends. Here's your friendly announcer. I have serious news to pass on to everybody. What I'm about to say could mean the world's disaster, could change your joy and laughter to breaking many
Breaking.